Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 3:08 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is July 1st and also, of course, the first day of the third quarter. And I find myself in a bit of a contemplative mood. I've posted a couple of different articles. The first is talking about the central or the Communist Party's centenary and the various statements made by Xi Jinping in his speech. I thought it was interesting that they forego the opportunity to have a military parade, even though the founding of the Communist Party and the subsequent success in the Civil War was certainly military, a military victory. And I always thought it was interesting that when they flew planes overhead, they made out the Western 100. With the planes rather than a Chinese character for 100. So that was obviously sending a message for the rest of the world that we've been around for 100 years. The one thing that I thought was interesting about the book The Fourth Turning is that they spent a lot of time talking about the 100-year cycle. And it kind of comes back to the Chinese way of thinking that wealth doesn't last for more than three generations. The first generation builds it, the second generation improves upon it, and the third generation spends it. And by the time it comes to the end of the third generation, the fortune is gone and it's a distant memory. And then it's up to the next generation to go off and make their way in the world again. And of course, that's the long-term way of thinking about history from a Chinese perspective. And we see parallels in lots of other societies as well, where there is this cyclical way of thinking about the world and society. It was evident in the Greeks, evident in the Romans, and evident in the argument from the Fourth Turning is that it's clearly evident as well in the USA. But is it still evident in China? That's, I think, one of the bigger questions. And we're in an environment today where there's a lot of uncertainty because people feel that there's something has changed and that there are big events that have transpired and are transpiring, and there's a lot of uncertainty about where to invest, what to do, and how things are going to pan out over the future. So we have to go back and start thinking about the things we do know. So we do know that the one thing that politicians want more than anything else is to remain in office. So they're going to choose the path of least resistance, and that generally means more spending. So when they can achieve more spending, and even then in times when they go for balanced budgets, they do so in a manner that helps to support large segments of the economy. So we know that there's probably going to be plenty of additional spending. And there's no real appetite for fiscal conservatism. We don't get appetite for fiscal conservatism until after the effects of fiscal laxity are clearly evident. And they're just not evident right now. Because if we look back at the Tea Party movement, which was imposing rigor on the US budget and looking at balanced budgets, and we look at the fiscal conservatism that resulted in the Eurozone, well, all that did was lower standards of living for vulnerable people and people that are at the lower end of the middle classes. It sparked a populist revolution, and there is just no way we're going back to that without a clear answer for how can we improve the standards of living for large numbers of people. And then we don't have any real evidence that we're going to have a big problem from spending a lot of money that we haven't earned or we don't have. So it's just going to be printed into existence. So it looks increasingly likely that the outsized unemployment benefits and social transfers that began during the pandemic will persist for longer than many people anticipate, and that it will form the basis for what is effectively universal basic income. And I'm thinking about the kinds of companies that generally do well in an environment where interest rates don't rise quickly. And the ones that kind of spring to mind are those that deploy a private equity hybrid model. So Danaher is one of those. And these types of companies don't generally fall into a handy category. And the one thing I think is rather interesting is that it has continued to move higher for 40 years. And it's been doing so in lockstep with the decline in yields. So this kind of hybrid private equity model is probably going to persist for as long as we have a compression in yields. And I'm just going to change the dates, and then we'll look at some of the other types of companies that do exactly the same thing. Because Thermo Fisher is another example of these kinds of companies that they redeploy large quantities of cash into R&D and acquiring other companies and dominating their respective small niches, so that the shares generally tend to go from left to right. And there are periods of time where they go sideways and then they tend to break out. So Thermo Fisher has been pausing over the last 6 months. And then we can think about Roper Industries. They do almost exactly the same thing. So they also deploy a hybrid private equity model, and that has generally transferred into rather impressive returns. And of course, one of the most famous is Brookfield Asset Management, where they are a private equity company and they've been redeploying their assets into the property markets for most of the last 20 to 30 years. The one thing that I find interesting about these kinds of companies is if we go back and look at their dividend history, because there are companies that we can think about, for example, the Dividend Aristocrats. Well, these are the kinds of companies that dominate their respective niches and have got strong balance sheets and long histories of increasing those dividends. So we're starting to see it steadying once more after a partial unwinding of an overbought condition. But the thing about the Dividend Aristocrats is that their yields tend to be rather low. So they have the potential to increase their dividends, and dividend growth was up around 13% last year and 8.67 over a 3-year average, but 12% over a 5-year average. But when we look at companies like Roper Industries, well, they don't concentrate on their dividend as much, but they do tend to grow it. So they have got low yields in absolute terms, but then they have tended to grow their dividend in excess of 10% per annum pretty much forever. And that pretty much puts them in the category of these dividend champions, the kinds of companies that will eventually become Dividend Aristocrats. Thermo Fisher isn't going to become a Dividend Aristocrat because they don't reliably increase their dividend every year, but they don't cut it either. And they've got very low dividends and high dividend growth. And then we can think about Visa. Well, Visa has got a long record of increasing its dividends in an aggressive manner. In fact, it's been doing so since it IPO'd. And it has a yield that's only at about 0.5%. And that's equally true of companies, like MasterCard, where we've had this clear process of increasing dividends in an aggressive manner, and then the share price rises to keep pace with that. So we continue to see that these types of companies are trending higher. And In a rising interest rate environment, it's the kinds of companies that have got dividend growth. They're the ones that really tend to perform well because you get some protection against inflationary pressures. When interest rates are rising, the kinds of companies that do least well are those that are heavily dependent on access to liquidity to fund unprofitable operations. So there's a good portion of the technology sector that would fall into that category. And then, of course, the big question outstanding is, well, where do interest rates go? So 10-year Treasury yields are hovering here around the 1.46% level. They haven't gone anywhere for 2 days. And there's a downward bias evident since March. That's following what was a really impressive breakout in yields from the end of last year all the way up to the peak around the 1.75% level. So we had the clear bounce from the region of the trend mean last week. We have not had follow-through on the upside this week, and there's still the downward bias. So it's going to require more than we've seen already to clearly confirm that this downtrend in yields has in fact bottomed. As we think about where are we in terms of the inflationary question, lots of the things that people are asking are highlighting as evidence of inflation are temporary in nature. So the big boom in lumber prices and the subsequent decline is one example. Right now, we're seeing a bump in propane prices because there was so much demand for outdoor heating during the winter, and stockpiles are down significantly. So, there's likely to have to be an additional rise in prices to compensate exporters for, or to encourage exporters to hold out and just sell domestically rather than export their supply. When we think about the broader agricultural commodity sector, we have these similar bottlenecks in terms of supply. And soybeans was able to hold on to the big upward dynamic that it had yesterday, although it was down mildly in here today. I do apologize if there's any sound of construction in the background as I'm recording. I'm not sure whether the microphone is picking it up, but I do have construction workers in the house today. When we think about where are we then in terms of this inflationary cycle, I'm not so much worried about these temporary overhangs or hangovers from the shock of the pandemic, but rather it's the response of governments to the protest movements, because this is very similar to what we had in the 1970s. We had this supply shock, and then because of the protest movements that arose in the 1960s and the inflationary pressures that were set off, there were price controls introduced. Now, we do not have price controls today, but it was then when those price controls were abandoned that prices surged higher. So it delayed inflation and later exaggerated it, and then it made living more difficult for everyone. So there was a massive spike in demand for wages, and that's exactly what happened. There was massive wage inflation, and then subsequently, the devaluation of the currencies resulted in the oil embargoes being imposed, and that even further exaggerated inflation. So it ushered in a whole new period of a real respect for inflationary pressures and clear efforts to try and mitigate inflationary pressures. And then the liberalization of the economy, because the stranglehold that unions and labor had on the economy that was contributing to inflationary pressures. That was when globalization really took off. So today we're at the other end of that. We're looking at where people are wanting to have more power in the hands of labor, where there's a greater respect for domestic labor over international labor, and where there is a clear determination to try and give people a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, or to compensate them for the difficulties that they're having. I think it's increasingly likely that we are going to have universal basic income. In other words, that it's not just simply going to be announced on any given day, but that the range of outcomes that are likely, it's that politicians are more likely than not to just keep the outsized programs that were introduced during the pandemic in place. And it will translate into much higher transfers to people that are not working or have no intention of working. So it brings us back to that question of inflation. It's not really about the pop in commodity prices. And commodities are volatile, and the prospect of the frost in Brazil sent prices higher yesterday for sugar, and then they came right back down today as some of the temperatures started to warm up. But broadly speaking, this is still an uptrend, and it looks like it is going to consolidate a little before we continue to see additional upside. Of course, a lot of people are thinking, well, if there is an inflationary problem, why isn't gold doing better? And gold has been certainly in a corrective phase over the course of the last 9 months, but we may be in the process of putting in a higher reaction low. Now, it has not yet convinced anyone that this is the higher reaction low that a lot of people have been waiting for. It's going to have to do better than it has done, but there is enough out there on the macro background to support the view that there is the potential for gold to start catching a bid again, to at least be optimistic. Of course, the relative strength of the dollar over the last few weeks has certainly been something that has weighed on that view, and the dollar pushed up to a new recovery high in here today. And this continues to look like a pretty firm environment overall. So, this continued rebound in the dollar is something that is very much responsible for the continued outperformance of Wall Street. But then we also have, if gold and the commodity complex are going to start doing better, and lower valuations and stronger balance sheets are going to have a better time in the markets, well, then that should favor international markets. Europe was in positive territory today, and it continues to trend higher in a reasonably consistent manner. And the Japanese market remains in a sideways to lower range overall as it consolidates between 30,000 and the region of the trend mean. The Chinese market was pretty much unchanged in here today, and I think that's probably by design. And the Indian market was also in mildly negative territory. When we think about where are we, well, there is obviously the alternative, and that inflation does not take off, and that it will be contained, and that the rewards from technology will continue to filter down and contain inflationary pressures. Well, the Nasdaq was in positive territory and continues to push on to new high ground. And there's an argument that technology is always deflationary. There are always periods of time when technology does well, but then there are plenty of times over the last 60 years where technology has not done well. The pace of innovation is about human capacity and technology itself, and also about interest rates. And the duration on kinds of companies that focus on growth and less on cash flows, well, that's heavily influenced by the interest rate environment. So, as long as interest rates are not surging higher, then there is still potential for money to flow into the technology sector overall. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.